Welcome to Portia Pattern with Bracken Helms, the show where we hear Bracken and his distinguished guests from the Porsche community patter on about Porsches and all things automotive. Porsche Pattern is sponsored by Circuit 64. Circuit 64 creates authentic automotive apparel made for like-minded automotive enthusiasts. The links for Circuit 64 are in the show notes. Okay, let's get to it.
Tony Kallas, part six. In this one, we go into racing, you know, some of his racing past. We also go into some of the politics. And like last week with the 911R and the Monza story and how that's important in Porsche's history and all that it means. This is kind of a similar thing. I mean, he's talking about the cars he's got that he's helping race and, you know, the race teams prepping for the race is basically similar to the one that you can buy at the showroom. Where, I mean, he doesn't take a deep dive, but there's a lot of some of these other cars you're racing against. They're not the car you can buy at the showroom. There's a lot more stuff done to them. They are not the same car. So to me, that's pretty exciting and shows how Porsche is superior in a lot of ways. Anyway, here's part six of Tony Kallas. So what was your first racing team?
Well, my father. We raced in the 70s with RSRs and whatnot. And I would go with my father to different events. He wouldn't take me to Mexico City or Guadalajara. He didn't want me to be around the lack of any control over there or a lot of it. But, and then let's put this timeline together. So then I moved to California and I hadn't been in racing for a while. I had to be out of it because I moved out in roughly late 84, 85. And I went to work for Jim Bell on an American Indy Series Indy team. So in 87, I worked on an Indy car and I worked down at Glenn Blakely's shop down towards Long Beach. And that was a good experience working on the Craco Indy car. And then in 88, I went to work some on a Trans Am car, not a Trans Am itself, but a Trans Am series car like a Camaro. And I'm talking basic stuff here, you know, just, hey, I'll work for free. What can I do? Then after that, I decided to put all of my efforts into opening the shop. So in late 91, et cetera, I'm working on this. So I'm not working in racing. Open up the shop in 92. After a few years, I decided that I really miss racing. And I had a couple of employees here. So we moved here where we're sitting in my second year of being in business. Because this is my problem. This is how I am. I look at a one-bay shop over on Crenshaw Boulevard near Torrance Airport. And I said, this is all I'll ever need for the rest of my life. And that's where I met Mike Harmon. I had those strange, weird ways of perfectionism and the way the world should be. But that's what I thought. I thought, this is it. Well, a year down the road, I'm like, oh, this is not big enough. So I move into two bays. This is all I'll ever need for the rest of my life. Well, no, then we took the five bays next to it and then back to the two. And now we're as an addition. I think that sufficed. But so what I'm saying is I opened up in 92. A few years later, I missed racing so much. I had the employees. I went to work in Europe. Then I went to work in the US. And so what I was doing was flying back and forth in 96, 97, 98. I was flying back and forth working in Europe on race cars for teams and working in the US. You can only do that when you're young. Had a lot of relationships and girlfriends and all kinds of stuff, working at Le Mans and working at Nürburgring and A1 Ring and you name it. And in the US working for Rohr. And the Europe I was working for Cycle and Rook and these German teams, English teams also. In 98, I met a guy named Joel Reiser through Bruce Anderson. Bruce was an incredible Porsche guru. Bruce was an absolute incredible guy. And if you don't mind me saying, I would recommend anybody and everybody go out and get the 911 performance handbook of Bruce's. It's great. And I'm not saying that because I'm on the cover of the third edition, but it's a neat book with a lot of data and info you can learn. So that's two books now, right? Other than Malcolm Gladwell and Blink, which is great, and Outliers, you've got Pete Zimmerman's book of the used 911 story and Bruce Anderson's book, the 911 performance handbook. So then I was racing a lot and I met Joel Reiser, and Joel wanted to go racing. So it was called Reiser Kallas, and he brought his 911 RSR here from New York, from Rochester. We ran that team that was called, again, Reiser Kallas. And then that went on through about 2001. We had Hurley Haywood. We had David Murray. We had Craig Stanton. I brought Craig Stanton to pro racing for the first time. It was a neat experience. Doc Bundy, we pulled him out of somewhat retirement, semi-retirement, and he raced for us. Hurley was a very big inspiration for me and a mentor in racing, and he taught me various things. Then Joel decided to quit racing, so 2002 through 2007, I ran a team for Bob Rodriguez, which had a pretty big hedge funds company in LA called First Pacific Advisors. And then around 2007, I decided I needed to quit racing and go get married. So I quit racing. I got married. I have these specific things in my life that I feel I need to do. And then I go out and date and I get it done. A lot more to that story. But then I quit racing. So basically 08 until... COVID?
2020 was COVID.
2020, that's it. But I got talked into going racing again by Daniel Espinoza, which was a client. It took him about a year, and I said, no, I'm over racing. Because, you know, racing is like, not that I know, but it's kind of what you hear of being in the mafia. It's hard to get out. Racing, once it gets in your blood, you know, it's very difficult to cut that. I finally got out of it, but then Daniel pulled me back in 19, and then in 2020 we raced his Cayman. You know what he did? He goes, Tony, you decide what car, you decide what series, you decide everything, and I'll just buy him. So we bought a Cayman MR, 2020 Cayman Manti car. You know, there's three versions of the Club Sport, and we can talk about that later. The ultimate is the Manti, with the carbon fenders and all kinds of differences about that. But we ran that car for 2 years. And then Daniel goes, okay, I got to stop, but I'm going to build a house here in Palisades. He's a home builder, Espinoza. And the problem is he builds houses like I work on cars. We only want to do it absolutely the best. So then I came back to LA. I know I'm going a little deeper into this, but I came back to LA. We were here a week. And when I got a call from Terry Borcheller, and he goes, I want you to test this guy, Nick Shanny. And that's how we ended up racing the Supras. So I'm probably way off topic there, but you get the idea.
What were some of your biggest wins?
You know, there's personal, and then there's the obvious. There's Le Mans 2001. There's Daytona 97. We did well in 96, but then the engine conked out. But 97 Daytona, 98 Daytona. I mean, you can't take away wins from those incredible races. So probably Le Mans when we got the trophy for Mechanic of the Year, you know. I ran Le Mans four times.
What car was it in 2000?
It was the GT3R, the 996 GT3 RSR, sorry. And
what team was that? Roar?
Cycle,
okay. Oh, the Roar was the GT1, right?
Roar was the GT2 and then GT1. Okay. And that GT1 actually started in Europe where I worked on it there. And then when the guy here bought it, I had been working for him. Just kind of a coincidence, I guess.
What is the Bosch technical degree?
There aren't a lot of things you can do to get training in the U.S. If you work for a Porsche dealer, they'll send you the Porsche schools. But when you're an independent, there aren't a lot of places you can go. Worldpack, which I've worked for now 15 years as a trainer. I've been the only independent Porsche trainer for that long in Canada and USA. It's not easy to find training. A company named SSF and Worldpack both have done it. They're parts companies. They have an agenda, but they're helping. You know, they're not really making money, but they want people to buy their parts. But I found the Bosch master's degree. And I couldn't eat it up. I couldn't get it fast enough. So I would fly to Chicago and take those classes and spend a lot of time with Ryan Barr and those guys over there learning about theory. And it's almost like I have multiple PhDs with all the training that I've taken and gone and studied and sat and read. You know what I mean? Just tried to really understand theory.
Why do you not watch auto racing?
It's not, well, first of all, I don't have the time. Second of all, I have started over the last couple of years, I've watched more auto racing, but it's difficult for me to sit down for an hour or two and watch it. I get a little bit of benefit because the Carrera Cup series is shorter and it's easier to watch, but I get tired of listening to some of the commentators and I know there's inconsistencies and incorrect items, But it's just difficult for me to sit. It's like that classroom desk outside. It's hard for me to sit that long.
Favorite track or race?
You know, Sebring's known as one of the worst, but I do love the track. It's very hot there, and it always rains. I think I like that, how difficult that is. But I don't really have a favorite track or a favorite race other than Le Mans and Daytona by what. But I hate 24-hour races. They're just tough on the body. But, you know, the most difficult for me are, they're real alluring.
What do you consider your crowning achievement?
Probably becoming a better person and working on controlling my reactions. I think there's a lot of things we can't control, but we can control how we react and how we say things and how we treat people.
Okay, you say that Le Mans was one of the worst experiences of your life, unless I got this wrong, and racing didn't really fit your personality traits. Why?
You're dealing with a lot of people. And, you know, there's a certain thing to be a teammate and be part of the team, but there's also dealing with difficult people. There's a lot of difficult people in motorsport. There's a lot of controlling and a lot of egos. Being an American running a German team wasn't easy. A lot of times you have to be the bad guy when you're the boss and people don't like it. And they make it sound like there's mistakes that are, you know, well, oh, we're sorry, we left you. We thought, you know, it was a mistake, or we didn't understand what was supposed to be. Yeah, right. You know where people can be pretty mean at times.
What series was the 97 win? That was with the GT1, right?
Yeah.
That was a championship.
Yeah.
In IMSA or WEC?
It was IMSA. Okay. But it was basically called something different at the time.
America Le Mans?
There was America Le Mans, but there was Porsche China PSR or something.
Okay.
Trying to remember what it was called, but there have been different names, and then USRC we raced in also. Sports car, I think it was called at the time.
Laguna Seca, you were doing well and beating the factory car, so the factory made you switch cars?
You have to realize that the Porsche factory, you put yourself in their position and they have somebody that they've given a car to for winning a championship, and then that car is doing well. They need to take credit for that situation. You know, I can go pretty deep into that, but I would say that Porsche needed to flex their muscles because that car was doing really well at that time, and it turned backwards. If you watch the race, it's on YouTube. Alan Minish and I had Hans Stuck as a driver, Terry Bootsen. There's a lot to it. There's a lot of politics there.
Yeah. The word politics got brought up a lot when I was talking with Jerry Woods. So I just wanted to add this in case you did want to look it up on YouTube or something. So it was 1997. So just look up, I don't know, 1997 FIA GT, 1997 Laguna Seca, Alan McNish, Hans Stuck. Obviously, race cars don't necessarily have the sponsors that are on their car. Like if they have a Valvoline sticker, necessarily mean they have Valvoline oil.
Yeah, we have to be super careful about what we say, but just because a race car has a decal doesn't mean that's what we use. And we want to use the best. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you, so we have to be careful about who gives us money and what we do. But I also want to make sure the engine lasts.
So all you need is a VIN to cut out from a body, and you can put it in a body of white to consider it that same car, right?
Porsche's changed that whole thing where for years you had to cut the VIN out of the car, of the race car, the crash race car. If you deem that car is no longer worthy of being a race car and it's going to get crushed, which it will have to be, you cut the VIN out. You have to send the VIN to Porsche and they will send you a chassis with that VIN stamped into it. And there have been situations and instances over the years where two race cars have showed up with the same VIN, and we won't talk about Florida shops or anything like that.
911 chassis are the same as the street cars, whereas a lot of the other manufacturer or competition is not the same chassis as their race cars. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about competing against the other teams that have their...
I think it's pretty obvious. We run a factory race car, tin top race car, with the chassis that comes right off the assembly line with the same spot welds and everything, where you've got a purpose-built race car, maybe by somebody that starts with a C and ends with an E. And they build the whole car up with proper suspension and everything. That's not a homologated car. We want to be, I mean, just think, the car that you buy out of the showroom is the same, very similar car that you, that we're racing. It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Right. I mean, yeah.
And it's not fair for us when, okay, I can go off on this for a little while, but the Vipers from the team Oreca, the French team, that was definitely not the car that you bought off the Chrysler showroom or whatever, whoever sold that car. The Porsche was, okay, we had some modifications to the engines, but the chassis alone and the suspension and the control arms, very similar.
The car you buy from the dealership is the same that they're racing, and there's nothing...
Very similar.
Those are good stories I like to hear about.
Not and like- you know what I like? I like seeing that we have, let's call it a wheel bearing problem or a control arm problem, and we fix that at the track. I had a fuel pump relay problem one day, and then the next thing you know, 6 months later, whenever it is, you see that there's a bulletin on the streetcar to change this. I know what we're doing is helping and making those streetcars better.
How do you deal with driver superstitions or rituals?
Oh, I think it's amazing. I mean, there's certain things. I've got a little yellow duck in our motorhome, and there's a bunch of things. I'm fairly superstitious, and I'm trying to get away from it some. But I got to tell you, it's not easy to handle that, because you get these ideas of what's going to help you win the race, and you feel you have to do it all the time. And there are certain people that are absolutely not superstitious surrounding you, and they laugh and they don't understand the difference. So I think it's great to watch Alan McNish stand there and lean on pit wall, or Andy Pilgrim put his hands together with his gloves and his fingers, and he's tightening his gloves. And these things these guys do to switch like that from being a regular person to the super driver, and you watch how they switch and they turn off from one to the other. It's brilliant.
What team did you like working with best?
My own.
Okay. I know there's definitely the politics involved, but what can you tell me? Like, I know that you put cars on the transporter at night for fear of monkey business.
Like, it's widespread. And when you have millions of dollars on the line, all it takes is to unzip that trailer tent and walk in and drop a nut down, an oil cap or something very benign, where who knows what's happening. It happens. I hate to live in that world, and I hate to have that in my brain. But when there's that much money on the line and your name's on the car, you put those cars away at night, because nobody can, you don't want anybody touching them, because every once in a while there'll be a stray person that ends up in your tent and they don't belong there.
Okay, so this is the one issue, like, I love racing, but the one issue that always creeps into my head is the fact of, like, the racers out there, oh, they're amazing talents, and I'm not taking anything away from them, but
well, they're not,
it's not like basketball. It's not like everybody has access and you're really getting the best of the best.
It's about money now. There's so many drivers out there that are great, and we'll never find them because they don't have the money to get into a car. That's where we really love watching the Acuras or the Miata series, and that alone, go-karts, follow go-karts. It's still, those alone are crazy expensive, but yeah, there's so many kids that won't have that chance.
Okay. So back in the day, car companies, like when they went and raced, it was really them winning, and it still is that way now. But like, let's say you got a car manufacturer that's never had a sports car, that's never won any sort of racing heritage. Could they not just use their money to go hire the best drivers, the best mechanics that don't actually even work for the company?
Okay, so what you're saying makes me think of something totally different. I'm looking at cars nowadays on showrooms. They go from theory to the finished product very quickly, and they're using the client as R&D. And you're seeing a lot of problems in street cars that you shouldn't, where Porsche years ago used to run them over rocky roads and Porsche still does that, by the way. They still run them out in Africa and in California in frozen conditions. You have to realize there's still a dead time. There's still time it takes to develop something. Sure, you can be Elon Musk and want to go race Porsches. You can hire the best. But in the end, there's still that steep learning curve. And it's not that easy to gel. Am I answering that question?
Yeah. When I read about old Porsche racing cars, back in the day, Porsche was kind of an underdog because they were a very small company.
Oh, they were sewing machines. People looked at them like, oh, they're driving up to the hamburger stand and they're sounding like sewing machines. And there's these big V8s. Imagine how people looked at it. I mean, anything different, we don't like it. Yeah, they were definitely different. And we were learning about roller cranks and everything that Dr. Porsche had come up with. I just spoke about this in Chicago the other day about how Dr. Porsche was an engineering marvel, right? And he worked for Daimler, and he worked for Count Sasha. But people just weren't used to it. And so anything they're not used to, they don't like.
Okay, so with that, they used to kind of be at a disadvantage with some of the big racing organizations mm-hmm. because they would set rules that kind of was like, and they're just the little guys, so they can't really fight it. When did Porsche, or have they still... Now that they're a big, huge company, when did it start getting to the point where Porsche could start pushing their trips on the politics back?
When you go to Le Mans and you win in a little SL Porsche or a little 356, or you start building a name that way. Otherwise, nobody cares. But when you run Pikes Peak and you do well, or you run Le Mans, or you run Nürburgring and you do well, that's when people start paying attention.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, comment, like, and share with your friends. Feel free to send questions or suggestions to the email in the description of the show. Special thanks to our sponsor, Circuit 64. Goodbye for now. We hope we can get together again for our next episode. Now get out there and enjoy the cars and the people.